want to, just for a few minutes, I want to back up to yesterday's classes because I think I may have confused a few people. Yesterday, I think I confused some folks with regards to the Maccabees because I was thinking about Adolph Eichmann and Breckinridge Long, but I was talking about the Maccabees, so I left out the punchline. But anyway, I skipped a paragraph in yesterday's class, and, you know, the point was that the events surrounding Antiochus and the Maccabees present a type at the end of days wherein the king of the north, namely Gog and Russia, will occupy Egypt and proceed north and east to Jerusalem, where he will take control of the city precisely as Daniel predicted. Daniel 11, verses 44 and 45. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and to utterly make away many. And he shall plant the tabernacle of his palaces between the seas in the glorious holy mountain, and they shall come to his end, and none shall help him. So then, just the Maccabees, the Maccabees then just came out of nowhere, as will the rainbow angel intercede and destroy the armies of the king of the north and rebuild the temple. So the era of the Maccabees was prophesied in Daniel 11, 32 and 34. And then in that same chapter, in verses 40 through 45, the antitype of the Maccabees was also prophesied. So that's what the Maccabees was all about. And then, leaving that paragraph out yesterday, what happened was I continued to talk, and when I was talking about Adolph Eichmann, and I said, remember Adolph Eichmann, some of you thought that I was thinking, well, he's going to connect Adolph Eichmann to the Maccabees and Armageddon. Well, I wasn't. Had nothing to do with that. Okay, but I do want to go back, and the reason that I asked for that show of hands yesterday, and the reason I pointed out Adolph Eichmann was, is all those people that did hold up their hands yesterday, you need to go back. There's about a 2-page biography online. Just type in biography Adolph Eichmann, and it'll bring it up. You need to read that. You need to remember who he was, and that's why I didn't want you to forget that. Because it has to do with the Holocaust, and I'm here to tell you that there's only about 3 people here in this room that actually can remember the Second World War. The rest of them are gone. So if we want to keep this thing alive and remember what the Holocaust is all about, and I'm fixing to tell you just a little bit more about it here in a second, but if you want to keep that alive, you need to teach your children. If you fail to teach your children about the Holocaust and what that whole series of events means, then we're going to be just like the children of Israel. We won't be able to remember what our fathers taught us. So we need to keep that alive. And every once in a while, maybe once a year, there'll be a Holocaust speaker come to Arkansas, and we'll go out to hear him. And their stories are amazing. So if you have the opportunity to go listen to one of them, do so, because the Holocaust survivors are just like the ones who witnessed the Second World War. There's not very many of them left, so you won't have much of an opportunity to listen to them very much longer. So then, that whole series of events that were surrounding the Second World War and the Holocaust, it was paving the way for the Jews to return to Palestine, because remember, after the Second World War was over, all the homes of the Jews were destroyed. They didn't have any place to go. Not any of the nations wanted them. Nobody wanted the Jews. So they were kept in these DP camps. They didn't have any place to go, and the only glimmer of hope that the Jews had was to go to Palestine. And the hand of providence was directing those affairs, and that's what the Second World War and the Holocaust was about, to direct the Jews to their Palestinian homeland and to establish a colony there that would serve as a nucleus and the basis of future operations in the Middle East. So that's why I wanted you to remember Adolph Eichmann. Look that stuff up on a computer. Just type in their names, and there's a jillion names. Adolph Eichmann, Klaus Barbie, Heinrich Himmler, Reinhard Heydrich, you know, and just a whole bunch of them. You need to know what they did to be able to remember those things and to appreciate what the Holocaust meant. Okay, so yesterday we ended our class at the close of World War II, and today, instead of jumping forward 100 years, I want to go to backtrack about 50 years from 1945, because there are some very important and significant events that happened during that time. Now, we know that most of you are familiar with all these things. Some of you may not be. So for you, we cannot emphasize enough the importance of the historical events that occurred because of the phenomenon that took place between 1896 and 1948. Because this became the greatest witness to the veracity of the Word of God in modern times. And the brethren of those days were so excited to see these things come to pass, and many of them believed that they were witnessing the fulfillment of Ezekiel 37, which of course speaks of the revival of the Valley of Dry Bones. They had every right to be excited, but the prophecy of Ezekiel 37 would have to wait for several more years. So what they saw was only a partial and primary restitution of the Jews. And what we're about to say is based on Zechariah the 12th chapter and verse 7. Zechariah 12:7. The Lord also shall save the tents of Judah first. He shall save the tents of Judah first. Remember that. That the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem do not magnify themselves against Judah. This was also typified by David when he reigned over Judah in Hebron for 7.5 years. Prior to his 33-year reign over the whole house of Israel in Jerusalem. And you can read all about that in 2 Samuel chapter 5. Brother Thomas in Elpis, Israel, on page 441, said that the return of the Jews to the land would be accomplished in two stages of restoration. And he accurately predicted that there would be a migration of Jewish people to Palestine before the return of Christ. This is a quotation from Elpis, Israel. And Brother Thomas writes, "There is then a partial and primary restitution of Jews before the manifestation, which is to serve as the nucleus or basis of future operations in the restoration of the rest of the tribes after he has appeared in his kingdom. The pre-adventual colonization of Palestine will be on purely political principles, and the Jewish colonists will return in unbelief of the Messiahship of Jesus and of the truth as it is in Him. They will immigrate hither as agriculturalists, traders, in the hope of ultimately establishing their commonwealth, but more immediately of getting rich in silver and gold and commerce with India and in cattle and goods by their industry at home under the efficient protection of the British power." And Brother Thomas wrote that over 100 years before it happened. Brother Thomas was not a prophet. He just simply interpreted prophecy, and he interpreted absolutely correctly in that case. So that prediction was true right up until the British mandate of Palestine expired, of which we'll have more to say in just a few minutes. So 13 years after Brother Thomas penned those words, 13 years after Elpis, Israel, there was a man named Mila Binyamin Zaev who was born in 1860 in Budapest, Hungary. He became a journalist, a playwright, a visionary, and a political activist. And this man's vision is summarized in this quotation when he wrote, "Palestine is our unforgettable home. The very name would be a force of marvelous potency for summoning our people together." And of course, we know this man better as Theodore Herzl. And on February the 14th, On February the 14th, 1896, Herzl published a 49-page booklet that was entitled Der Judenstaat, or The Jewish State. And the booklet was a proposal for a modern solution to the Jewish question. And this is the concluding paragraph of that booklet. Incidentally, has anybody read that book? Der Judenstaat is 49 pages. It's like a pamphlet. You ought to read it. You will be enlightened when you finish reading it, because the man had all the bases covered. He knew exactly how to get this thing started. Okay, and this is on page 49, the closing paragraphs of that booklet. He says, therefore, I believe that a wondrous generation of Jews will spring into existence. The Maccabees will rise again. Let me repeat once more my opening words. The Jews who wish for a state will have it. We shall live at last as free men on our own soil and die peacefully in our own homes. The world will be freed by our liberty, enriched by our wealth, magnified by our greatness, and whatever we attempt there to accomplish for our own welfare will react powerfully and beneficially for the good of humanity. And that may sound a bit on the arrogant side, but believe me, that's exactly what happened. The man was a prophet, truly a prophet. A year and a half after this work was completed, on August the 29th through the 30th in 1897, the first Zionist Congress was held in Basel, Switzerland. The purpose of the Congress was to lay the foundation for developing a plan for a future homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine. Herzl wrote in his diary, 2 days after this Zionist Congress, and he said, if I were to sum up the Basel Congress in one word, it would be this. At Basel, I founded the Jewish state. 20 years after this, in 1917, there was a fabulously wealthy Jewish banker who lived in London, England, and he was a financier, an active Zionist, and his name was Lord Walter Rothschild. That's him, top right. And he was a close friend to a man named Chaim Weizmann, an Israeli statesman, who became the first president of Israel in 1949 through 1952. And these two individuals worked together to formulate the draft declaration for a Jewish homeland in Palestine. The proposal was sent to the British Secretary of State, Arthur James Balfour, who afterward, having the proposal approved by the British government, replied to Lord Rothschild, and we're going to read that letter in just a second, but just a side note about this Chaim Weizmann here. Remember, this is 1917. What was going on in 1917? First World War. Okay, in the First World War, the British began to run out of explosives. They couldn't manufacture explosives because they ran out of acetone. So this man, Chaim Weizmann, besides being a statesman, he was also a biochemist. And he invented a new method for producing acetone. And as a result of his work and his contribution to the war effort in Britain, he was named among the elite of Britain. Everybody liked him. And he was very influential in bringing all of these things to pass. So next time you read about somebody, read about Chaim Weizmann. He was a very important element in the things that was bringing Israel back to Palestine. So anyway, Walter Rothschild, Chaim Weizmann, formulated a draft declaration for a Jewish homeland in Palestine. The proposal was sent to the British Secretary, Arthur James Balfour, who afterward, having the proposal approved by the British government, replied to Lord Rothschild, the leader of the Zionist movement in London, on November 2nd, 1917, with this letter. And we've all read that letter before. I'm sure we have. I've got a copy of it pasted in front of my Bible, so I won't forget about it. But it says, Dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you on behalf of His Majesty's government The following declaration of sympathy with Jewish aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object. It being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights of political status enjoyed by the Jews in any other country. I should be grateful if you will bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation, and it's signed Arthur Balfour. So after this Balfour Declaration, the British drove the Ottoman Turks out of Palestine, which paved the way for the Jewish migration. The Balfour Declaration was dated November the 2nd, 1917, and the Turks were driven out of Jerusalem on December the 11th, a month later. All right, and then the British Mandate of Palestine was set to expire at midnight on May the 14th in 1948, and just hours earlier, David Ben-Gurion read the Declaration of Independence before the world. And at 12:01 a.m., May the 15th, Israel became a state. And that very day, the 15th of May, 1948, these were the headlines of the New York Times. Note at the top, Zionists proclaim new state of Israel. Truman recognizes it and hopes for peace. Tel Aviv is bombed. Egypt orders an invasion. So as soon as they declared statehood and Truman recognized it, they immediately went to war. That very day that they declared statehood, the Arabs and the Egyptians jumped on them. Okay, now for just a minute or two, and I don't want you all to lose sight of the anti-Semitism that was involved in all of this. I mean, from reading that headline where it says Truman recognized it, that is the state of Israel, and he hopes for peace. That was great. He did that. He wrote the letter. As a matter of fact, that's it right there. And what he said was that one line down at the bottom. The United States recognized the provincial government as the de facto authority of the new state of Israel. And that's all he wrote about it. There's nothing else, just that. So then for a minute or two, I want to focus in on a couple of things regarding one, then President Harry Truman and the birth of the Jewish state, and two, the actions of the British. Now we point this out because things were not exactly as they seemed, and it was clear from these things that the whole affair was being directed by the hand of Providence. Because what appears on the surface was actually a set of circumstances that were the result of something else. And what the other things weren't exactly what we might expect. So we note then in the middle headline in the New York Times newspaper, Truman recognized it in the hopes for peace. During the previous year, in 1947, Harry Truman tried to dissuade David Ben-Gurion from proceeding with the planned establishment of statehood. And as a matter of fact, he talked to him at least on two different occasions. No, don't do this. This is not a good idea. And the reason he cited was that it would create reprisals on the part of the Egyptians and the Arabs. And another thing to remember is that at this same time, 1948 was a presidential election year, and Truman was after the Jewish votes in New York State, because at that time there were about 2 million Jews living in New York City, along with 47 electoral votes to be had there. And that was Truman's motivation for doing this, for writing this letter. So for Truman, the point is that had it not been in an election year when the British mandate expired and Israel declared its statehood, that Truman most likely would have made a different decision, because his entire cabinet was opposed to his decision, and General George Marshall, who was a very outspoken, gruff person, if you think George Mattis was bad, this chief of staff, George Marshall, he was as bad or worse. And in that meeting, when he was talking to his cabinet members, they all opposed it, And the chief of staff actually accused Truman of making his decision based purely on political reasons. In other words, he sat in that cabinet meeting and told Truman, the only reason you're doing this is to get the Jewish votes. And Truman didn't fire him, but they got in trouble. But George Marshall wrote books after that, and he said virtually the same thing. All right, so during this time then, the United States was allied with the Arab nations, and Truman had to appease them as well. So then Truman recognized the Jewish state, knowing full well that it would cause a war, and in fact did. Then he issued an arms embargo on Israel on top of that. And at that time, the Israelis only had enough small arms to arm about half of its army. They had pistols and rifles, and that was about it. And then President Truman recognized them as the state of Israel, then imposes an arms embargo and said, no, we're not going to give you any weapons, because he was trying to appease the Arabs. So he was talking out of both sides of his mouth. So Israel, though, managed to defend themselves, sometimes using only handguns and used rifles and what they could confiscate from the enemy. Then also, in May of 1948, the British were holding 26,000 Jews captive on the island of Cyprus, refusing to allow them to enter into the land of Palestine. And that was going on while David Ben-Gurion was issuing the Declaration of Independence. So the British then were still holding prisoners on Cyprus. So nobody wanted the Jews. They didn't want to support the Jews. The only reason they supported Truman supported the Jews was to get their votes so he could be elected president. So the point in all this is that in spite of the British and Americans, the Egyptians, the Arabs, the Jews were able to maintain, So the point is that in spite of the British, the Americans, the Egyptians, and the Arabs, the Jews were able to maintain their statehood, and they did it by the hand of Providence. And since that beginning, Israel has been in a near constant state of war, and this graphic that we have here shows some of the struggles that they endured in order just to survive. In 1948 through 49 was the first Arab-Israeli war. 51 to 55, they were reprisal operations. And in 56, it was the Suez War. 67, the Six-Day War. Then the War of Attrition, Palestinian insurgencies, the Yom Kippur War, and so forth and so on and so on. So from the very inception, from the very beginning of Israel's statehood, they have been in virtually a constant state of conflict. Now, I want to go back to something that Theodore Herzl said in 1896. And we've already read this, but it says, the world will be freed by our liberty, enriched by our wealth, magnified by our greatness, and whatever we attempt there to accomplish for our own welfare will react powerfully and beneficially for the good of humanity. And like I said a minute ago, some may think that that was an arrogant statement, but nonetheless, the man was a prophet, because that's exactly what happened. So then all these years, Israel has been steadily involved in seemingly unended military conflicts, but their accomplishments have surely exceeded the imagination of men like Herzl's. I have here a three-page list of things that the children of Israel, or that Israel has accomplished during their time in Palestine. And I have this slide here which lists only just a few of them. So these are some of the things that Israel has done that has benefited humanity. Israel invented the cell phone. I know there's a lot of people that say, wish you hadn't have done that, but... Nonetheless, they invented the cell phone. Israel designed and developed and produced the Pentium 4 and Centrino microprocessors, and probably the computer that you have at home has an Israeli processor in it. Israel has the fourth largest armed force, air force in the world. Israel has the highest ratio of university degrees to the population at 24%. and 12% of those hold advanced degrees. Israel is ranked second in the world for venture capital gains. Israel developed the first non-radiation diagnostic instrument for breast cancer. Israel developed the first ingestible video camera to detect intestinal cancers. And Israel leads the world in the number of scientists and technicians in the workforce. And that's just a small list of all the things that they've accomplished. Now, on another note, we can back up just a little bit. There were, how many of you know what the Manhattan Project is? Good. Okay, for those of you who don't know what the Manhattan Project was, there were 26 Jewish scientists who worked on the American Manhattan Project, which was the code name for the project that developed the atomic bomb in 1945. And its lead scientist was a man named Robert Oppenheimer, who obviously was a Jew. And all this was happening in John and Marie's backyard, about 60 miles from their house. And also, during the late 1930s, there were 1,150 Jewish scientists that had migrated to America due to fascist depression in Europe. And as of 1977, and I know this is old news, but it's still true, as of 1977, Jewish scientists represented 27% of American Nobel Prize winners while representing only 3% of the population. That's pretty outstanding, I'd say. So then, as we look at some of these accomplishments, we hearken back to what Theodore Herzl said. Whatever we attempt there to accomplish for our own welfare will react powerfully and beneficially for the good of humanity, and believe me, it has. So in answer then to Zechariah 12:7, how can the tents of Judah be saved first if they are not in the land prior to the advent of our Lord? They will be saved first because they are there. They are established in the land. They will be the first to be saved, and they are representatively and figuratively Benjamin and Judah. Currently, the Jewish population in Israel is around 6.3 million, and the population of Israel, I think, is about 8.3 million, but 2 million of them are not Jews or non-Jewish. Currently, the Jewish population in Israel is around 6.3 million. Worldwide, there are about 16 million Jews. The Jews living in the land at present symbolically constitute the tribes of Benjamin and Judah, and the remaining 10 tribes are numbered at more than 10 million and still in dispersion. So as of now, the joining together of Ezekiel's two sticks will have to wait for Elijah to complete his future work, which will begin after the judgment seat of Christ. So Ezekiel 37 has not been fulfilled. It is not going to be fulfilled until the work of Elijah commences. Then that will be the beginning of the fulfillment of Ezekiel 37. Regarding this people Israel, it must be kept in mind that we're dealing with Judah and Israel, that is the 10 tribes and the 2 tribes. And when we look at prophecy concerning Israel, we need to recognize whether of the two the scripture is speaking of. So let's go back to 1 Kings, the 11th chapter, and look at what was written there when the Lord said that he would rend the kingdom from Solomon. 1 Kings 11, verse 13. Howbeit, I will not rend away all the kingdom, but will give one tribe to thy son for David my servant's sake and for Jerusalem's sake, which I have chosen. In verse 32, but he shall have one tribe for my servant David's sake and for Jerusalem's sake, the city which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel. Verse 36, and unto his son will I give one tribe, that David my servant may have a light always before me in Jerusalem, the city which I have chosen me to put my name there. So Benjamin is considered part of Judah, and you can read about that in the 12th chapter of 1 Kings. So consider for a moment what would have happened to Jerusalem if Yahweh had not designated the city as the place he had chosen to put his name and that it, Judah would be its occupants. I think it would be a fair assumption that Jerusalem likely would have lost her entire identity and vanished into obscurity amongst the multitude of heathen Gentiles, like what happened in 134 AD when Hadrian leveled the Jerusalem and renamed the city. And we should remember that the genealogical line of David had to remain intact for Messiah's sake, who at that time, at the time of Solomon, in 1 Kings that we were reading of there, at that time, that man, Messiah, was 930 years into the future. So the inhabitants of Jerusalem today represent Benjamin and Judah, just as God had predetermined, and are the protectors of the city wherein Yahweh has chosen to put his name there. So as far as I'm able to determine, from the time of the division of the tribes of Israel to the present, there has always been a Jewish presence in Palestine and the areas immediately surrounding it, though at times they were small in number. But Yahweh has declared that Jerusalem shall be inhabited. Now, some of this may seem like it's all unnecessary details, but we need to keep in mind that these things constitute an important part of the things concerning the kingdom of God and the name of Jesus Christ. And it has to do with our immediate future. So let's look now at something that the prophet Ezekiel said in his 38th chapter. Ezekiel 38 describes the invasion of Israel by the Gogian horde, who comes to a land of unwalled villages where the inhabitants would be dwelling safely. And this is what Ezekiel says, Ezekiel 38, 11 and 12. And thou shalt say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates, to take a spoil, to take a prey, to turn thine hand upon the desolate places that are now inhabited, and upon the people that are gathered out of the nations which have gotten cattle and goods that dwell in the midst of the land. So then, the picture seemingly painted here speaks of a land that is quiet, serene, and at rest, that is, without a care. But this is not the true perception of what is intended. So if we look at that word safety, just a moment, we see that it is from Bitok, and it suggests a place of refuge, a thing of trust, assurance, boldly, confident, and surely, securely. So when I look at this in the context of the end of days, I believe that the idea that is being set forth here is that security, trust, and confidence, and not without a care, as some might like to think. Case in point, in January 2018 issue of the Bible magazine, there was an article that appeared that was entitled, In Wrath, Remember Mercy. It was by Timothy Billington. The thrust of that article dealt with Israel at the time of Armageddon, and the conclusions, their conclusions in this article are based on Jeremiah 30 and verse 7, which says, Alas, for the day is great, so that none is like it. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it. So this verse is interpreted to mean that there will be a time of Jacob's trouble, but Judah will be spared that trouble, that they won't have to deal with that trouble. And a quote from that magazine, it says, God reassures them and tells them, fear not, don't fear Armageddon. So in the conclusion of this article, the author also says, we have seen passages that speak of Armageddon as an event with virtually no impact on the well-being of Israelis, such as Isaiah 29, 7 and 8. We have seen that Zechariah's passage about two-thirds being cut off is difficult to identify with Armageddon. Daniel 12:1 falls into that same category, and I'm still figuring that one out. Ezekiel 38, Joel 3, Zechariah 14 actually have little to say that requires extensive destruction on Israel's part. So needless to say, we can't believe that for a minute, because it belies all that we know about the end of days, and it contradicts the truth of the gospel of the things concerning the end of time. So back to Israel dwelling confidently. To give us an idea of the trustworthiness, a few weeks ago, before Israel celebrated its 70th anniversary of statehood, I was reading a few articles from the Jerusalem Post, and among those articles that I was reading, there was an article that was entitled, 70 Years of Israeli Ingenuity, What is Israel's All-Time Top Invention? There was a list of about 9 or 10 innovations and inventions there, but it was stated that the Iron Dome missile defense system had been voted Israel's all-time top invention, and the system has already been highly successful to date at over 90% effective in intercepting incoming missiles. So according to what I see in the news, and especially what I hear from brethren and sisters who have been there, is that there is a constant military presence in Israel virtually everywhere you go. So as for me, I don't get the impression that the Israelis are living carefree. It seems more like a confident readiness to defend itself or to be on the offensive, whichever may be necessary. So, peace and safety in perspective. So what all this means to me is that we do not need to look for Israel to live in a common perception of peace and safety prior to the advent. But concerning latter-day peace and safety, the Apostle Paul, I think, puts it all in the right context when he said in 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 3 that a sign of the time prior to the Lord's return to establish his kingdom on earth would be when the Gentile world would say peace and safety. And this is a quote from Elpis Israel concerning that verse in 1 Thessalonians. Brother Thomas writes, the groans of nations ascending to heaven on every side, kindling embers of war, smoking in Rome, Vienna and Constantinople, and yet ye cry peace and safety? Surely you are incorrigibly demented and ripe for capture and destruction. So, for those who say that Israel will be in peace and safety, Brother Thomas says they are incorrigibly demented. So what we have then with Israel at the present is a nation that is ready for Ezekiel to unfold. And likewise, we see the sign of the nations of the world who cry for peace and safety. So I don't think that the elements of Nebuchadnezzar's image have yet come into place. In other words, I do not believe that the image is standing. Nonetheless, there are other factors concerning Israel and the world, and they have made and they are making themselves ready in advance of that time. So my belief is then that the second advent of Christ, the resurrection, the gathering of the living elect can happen at any moment. I don't see any prophecies that must be fulfilled prior to the gathering together of the living and the dead ones to stand before his tribunal. So what all this is telling me is that preparation time is running short, and we should get our house together, our lamps filled and burning. Otherwise, he will come upon us as a thief in the night, and we certainly don't want that to happen. We're almost out of time, but tomorrow we're going to go forward just a bit, and for our last class, we're going to continue dealing with Israel as a nation and a people rather than interfere with anything that's already been covered about the signs of the times. We're going to attempt to talk about two events simultaneously, if I'm able to do that, because there are two sets of events that will be happening in the age to come, and we need to be aware of both of them because they affect us. So that's what we're going to talk about tomorrow.